Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Open Mic Comedy Podcast. I'm your host, Mark. If this is your first time here, welcome. If you're a returning listener, welcome back. This podcast is for people on the open mic comedy circuit, whether you're a comedian, an MC, a promoter, a tutor, in fact, anybody who has any involvement in this industry. Even comedy fans who really do enjoy spending time in pub basements watching the possible stars of the future. If you're thinking, oh, I could do that, then this podcast will give you the inside track on what to expect on this crazy circuit. Today's guest is someone who has a lot of experience in the arts, working as an actor and a comedian. He is found performing all over, even somewhere in Bournemouth, according to his latest March 24 gig list. A friendly fellow who is supportive of new comedians he gigs with. He can be found regularly headlining at many open mic nights in London. He has the odd fight with a microphone and a stand, is sceptical when it comes to the Snowman movie, and is not sure the modern British audience would be ready for the war with Russia. Cover those vapes, people. Please welcome to the stage, Mr. Sam Addison.
Thank you. What an introduction. I've never had an introduction like that. That's amazing. Thank you so much.
I love the snowman bikes.
That's just one of those things. That's just like, you know, when you spend hours looking for a joke.
Yeah.
You spend hours like agonizing over it. And then just before you go on stage, something just goes bloop. And it's like way better than anything you could spend hours writing on. That was literally one of those. So I'll go into that a bit. It's one of my favorites. I think it's the best thing I've ever written. So I think I might just go into that later.
And you got the chance to test it immediately from when you thought about it.
Yeah. And it was just, you know, when sometimes you hit something, you're like, oh, with a little bit of work, this could kill.
Yeah.
Or with a lot of work, it could kill. But with that, it was just like, I just know that's going to be funny. So I'm going to probably say goodbye to it soon because it's just been a part of my set for so long now.
Oh, okay.
But, you know, as I say, who knows? It might still be there in 3 years if we're still there. I don't know.
So come on, how long have you been doing this? And
right.
What's the background?
Mark, there's a long answer and a short answer to this. The short answer is June 2021. Is how long I've been doing stand-up. And so what's that, nearly 3 years?
Yeah.
So I'll say that's how long I've been taking it seriously in terms of trying to do as many gigs as possible and wanting to get really good at it and just seeing what happens. However, the first time I ever did a stand-up gig was in 2010 or 11.
Wow.
So I was very, very young, and it was... I was in a theatre company called Fourth Monkey, and it was like a training theatre company because I didn't get into drama school. So I joined this theatre company, but it was amazing. It was like we were a band of misfits, and it was physical theatre, and it was all like, it was really fun. But they had a talent show at the basement of the Leicester Square Theatre. So, you know, the Leicester Square Theatre. It's just this tiny room underneath it. And... And I was like, you know what, I'm going to do some jokes. I've always wanted to do it. And I did, a set, and it didn't go awfully.
Yeah.
It also didn't go well, but it didn't go awfully. And obviously I was in front of a bunch of people that I'd already known for years by this point, a year and a half or so. And ever since I did that, I was like, this could be fun. And then we ended up going to, as a theatre company, went to Edinburgh, and this would have been in 2012 at this point. And I was just, we were doing a play. And there was, I just saw lots of open mic stuff around, and I was like, okay, well, I'll give it a go. So then I did like two gigs in Edinburgh, and then I got to London. And I thought, I'm going to do this instead. Yeah. And so I did like open mic nights in London back then. Some of the same nights that still survive today, a lot brand new ones. A lot of them haven't survived. Obviously we had COVID and all that since then.
Yeah.
And I thought you had to write a new 5 minutes every single time you went on stage. So I was doing about a gig every 2 months thinking this is it. And just stressing myself out. And then I was like, you know what? Maybe not right now. So I did it. I pursued acting after that for a while. Then I was about 25, I was like, you know, I want to give stand-up another go. And that lasted about a month because no one wanted to come. It was all bringer shows, obviously.
Yeah.
No one wanted to come because friends are, despite the fact that all my friends live very close, like including friends that I've grown up with and went to school with, they live just over there. Right. I never see him. I never see him. Like, we live closer than we did back before I moved back to London. I never see him. So my girlfriend was my bringer, and she couldn't do it anymore. She just couldn't. There was one gig that we were in I can't even remember the name of the night, but it was in summer, and we were in central London, somewhere like Holborn, and it was above a pub. And you know when it's summer and it's daylight streaming in the windows and it's 7 p.m., you're like, no one's in the mood to hear about dick jokes. And so we got there and it was tiny. There was like hardly anyone in the audience. And there was an old man there who was sitting at the back who I thought was a secret critic or a secret. He was an hour early to his book club. So he was just sitting there. He was just sitting there just like tutting loudly during all of the set. And I think at one point I said a joke that didn't land and I looked my girlfriend dead in the eye and all I saw was her going like, so I was like, oh, okay, I can't, I need to kind of rejig. So, and then as we were leaving, the other members of the gentleman's book club arrived and he just said very loudly, I just sat through the most awful comedy show. I was just like, ugh. So then I stopped again and then lockdown happened and I went crazy and I thought I was going to be a poet and I started drawing portraits of people. Such the wankiest lockdown in the world. And then I was like, you know what? I like writing. I like jokes. Let's just write some jokes. And then I found an online course during lockdown. And so on the gig I did on the 21st of June, 2021 was supposed to be the first were freedom, but then we got locked down again. So that was the day, and that was at the Cavendish Arms. I haven't been back since. oh God. But yeah, so two answers. Long answer, on and off, badly for about 10 years.
Yeah.
Good answer, about two and a bit years, taking it super seriously, essentially.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was going to say, when you started talking, I was like, oh, so you didn't really go via the traditional course route, and then we're thrown in an online course at the end just to bolster things.
Because, like, I think courses are really, and then depending on the course that you do, it's obviously some purists are like, you either got it or you don't. And there is some truth to that. I think when it comes to like timing or just thinking, just being able to have a good sense of humor, not necessarily crafting jokes, but like laughing easily and not taking yourself seriously.
Yeah.
That's kind of like that you could learn to not take yourself so seriously, but it can be quite a path. But I genuinely needed to learn how to write a joke because I was just getting by on personality. And I was just like, look, I've come up with an idea and just talk about the idea without going, yeah, but there's so many jokes in that you are just going, this is a concept and just giving it to the audience and making them do the work.
Yeah.
And not knowing why they're not laughing. And so, yeah, I needed a course just to channel that energy into something that resembles a setup and a punchline. And then knowing the rules to then break the rules and all that jazz.
I do think the course is a... I mean, pretty much most people that I've spoken to that have started comedy in the last few years have come via the course route.
Yeah,
I think the course just you don't become funny. You unlock something that's in there, and you find out on the course if you do have something or not.
Yeah,
whether it's ever going to be anything massive or not, but you'll find out if you are that person that tells the stories to your mates at the pub. Mm-hmm. Whether you can actually tell that story to strangers and get them laughing. But it also, I think it gives you the confidence to give it a go.
Yeah. And I think like, so giving it a go is like, oh, it's the scariest thing. Although sometimes, you know, it's and I kind of agree with this, when comedians are so brave. I mean, it's like braveness and stupidity are very close together, I think. It's brave to do something, feel scared and doing something. And but at the same time, it's like you're not really going to die. And I think it's an interesting type of person who is comfortable or gets comfortable with humiliation. And I feel like so many people are scared of being humiliated in this day and age. I mean, it's not fun. Like, don't get me wrong. It's not like, I can't wait. It's like, but it's just something that, I don't know. I think it's just because I was humiliated so often as a kid, like growing up, just being bullied and all that stuff. It's just kind of, if I could use that power to create a career, then it's like,
yeah,
it's the best university I could have had.
Yeah, I get that. I mean, I'm sure a lot of people on this circuit were the bullied rather than the bullies when it comes to the whole school life. And you do pick out things from here. And I'm actually I'm kind of in the process of trying to formulate a set based on being bullied. And I know a lot of people have kind of done it, but
everyone's got a unique story with it, though.
Yeah, it's trying to bring something into the audience to say, okay, I was the butt of all of this, but you can laugh. I'm giving you permission to laugh at my expense, because I find this as a kind of therapy.
Yeah, and in a way,
there's things at the end of it that are lined up in my head, because I don't know if it'll ever see the light of day, but one of the people that made really petty in a way, made an extremely mean comment to the other 200 people that were on that Friends Reunited ball when I thought I'd left school and got away from that hell.
Right.
Now turns out to be a headmaster of a local school to me. And it's just like, it's irony all over. It really is. And you get that, I've had it before, where you get the occasional friend that, or say ex-friend or person from school that will send you an invite for a friend on Facebook, and you kind of go, I really just want to reply and say, fuck off.
Yeah, exactly. But then they'll be like, what do you mean? They never remember.
Yeah, you're the guy that I helped get through the fact that his mother got diagnosed with cancer. His parents then got divorced. He then lost his driving license through drink driving, and I took him to work for a year.
Yeah.
And then he decided to throw concrete over my car.
Jesus Christ.
And you're like, wait, why did I not see this?
Yeah, exactly.
what was my clouded judgment? See, there's things like that. When I say that to somebody, they're like, fucking hell.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's a story that would be quite funny to say. I haven't found the perfect funny way to
say it.
That's
the issue, because like the audience just would feel sorry for you, and you'll have a lot of R's and like all this stuff. I think, I don't know, it's you obviously can't probably show his face on the internet or anything, but if there's, because you see comedians that do the like a PowerPoint presentation, and they get like emails from things.
Yeah,
if you were to just have a little message to and fro, just to see, maybe there could be something in that. And the great thing is, if it is, it's the ultimate, even if it doesn't go to anything, it's kind of like payback in a way, because it's your kind of like, you're milking this for material.
Yeah.
And so you've kind of made up your mind about who the guy is if he's throwing concrete over your car anyway, you know?
Yeah. I will say it was unset concrete. As in it was sand, basically. Gross.
But still, that hardens.
Yeah, and then it rained that night. It's just like,
what a funny guy.
Yeah.
What a character.
But yeah, it's an interesting one. How, I mean, I guess it's a common question, is how do we all come up with material? And it's just one of those, it comes from a random thought that you try and work out if you can develop something.
Yeah, pretty much. Or it's kind of string together two other ideas or what have you. Like, because you could have ideas that have been percolating in the back of your head for ages, and you think, you know, that could be work, but you sometimes feel not ready for it.
Yeah.
Because you just need to get used to saying crazier stuff on stage for the audience to then be like, hey, I've done this before, trust me. I can take you on this journey, it'll be okay, rather than this trauma and stuff. And they're just like, oh, I don't know how to react to that. And I'm guilty of that as well. Like, I come up with ideas that I think are hilarious, and ultimately people just go, that's awful. Why would you ever think that, let alone say it in front of people with a microphone, you know? So, you know, you have to kind of edit yourself a bit sometimes.
Yeah. So you've been taking this, so we'll look at the last 3 years then, for the next question, rather than delving back into the true past, unless we come up with something completely hilarious.
If I think of something, I'll let you know.
I guess the best and worst moments ever had on stage.
Best and worst. So I'll start with the best. I think there's so many. No, it's not. I think it's just genuinely, I think, the more you do it, the more you kind of realize that might work quite quickly, rather than going, oh, I'm going to see. But I still, any good moment, any great moment is when you come up with an idea and it makes people laugh that day. Like anything that you just go, oh, I could just literally think of stuff today and it can make strangers laugh. Yep. Once you realize you can do, and it's not going to happen all the time, don't get it twisted, but once you realize you can do that once in a blue moon, it kind of just ignites that thing in you that goes, I can't, I'm not hitting my head against the wall so much. Can actually, there's something in me that does this, does work. But if you were to put a label on a best gig, I think it would probably be the first time I beat the blackout at Up the Creek. Mm-hmm. Just because it's like, even though it was jokes that I know work, it's that, I have a weird relationship with gong shows anyway, in the sense that we're the only country that does it. What is that? Like, that's, it goes right back to like medieval jester shit, you know, with the Globe Theatre and all that crap. So Britain is a very kind of country, and obviously a massive drinking culture. So like that idea of the audience being able to vote off people on stage is just a weird thing. So the first time that I managed to get through 5 minutes, I was floating on a cloud for about 3 days after that. I didn't win it or anything. I just got through 5 minutes without being voted off. And it's fucking crazy as well, because like, if you think of a gong show as like a peer review, like usually if you work in advertising or what have you, you'll get judged by people that have worked in advertising, right? And we're being judged at a gong show by people that have never written a joke ever. And they're going, nah. But then again, it is that thing where you are being judged the second you walk out on stage anyway. So we are performing to people like that anyway. So
it's just an interesting twist to that then.
Yeah.
If that wasn't a gong show,
mm-hmm.
would that be one of your favorite moments on stage?
If it wasn't a gong show?
Yeah.
I think so, because it was just like, it was one of the biggest crowds I performed in front of at that time. There was about like 200 people in there.
Yeah.
And it was the first time, and this is going to sound wanky, but it's the first time you kind of felt, I felt a laugh go back and then forward again.
Yeah.
Because as you know, so often these rooms are the size of a shoebox. And sometimes, and the great thing about Up the Creek, it's designed perfectly for comedy. It's got a low ceiling. It's got the perfect like kind of curved seating going around, and it just goes further back into the darkness. And that's really conclusive, because hysteria spreads a lot quicker in a low ceiling. I don't know why. There's less stuff going up. There's less air above you. Mm-hmm. So it kind of feels like you're more in a little kind of vestibule of things can spread a lot easier in that.
Yeah.
So I feel like it still would have been the best moment, I think, because it's just like, it was just perfect to me. That set could not have gone better, I don't think.
Cool.
Everything I thought that would hit.
Yeah.
Some extra bits happened. Some person dropped a glass and I made a joke about that. And that's like little lightning things like that, which just kind of helped. So
I think those are the joys that I take away from if I'm on stage and something happens and I'm quick-witted enough to make a comment or something and it gets a little bit of a laugh, but 99% of the time I always get that thought after I've come off stage going, I could have said that, but right when down. You get it on the stage, it's like,
the second, all you need is a couple of stock phrases that are yours that whenever that does happen, you can just fire them out. And that's the thing, because whenever you do, like, crowd work is incredible. I don't do that much of it. I want to do a lot more. I want to do a lot more emceeing, but crowd work is like, for the audience, it's like watching a magician do real magic. It's like, wow, how did he do that? How did he connect that? You know?
So yeah.
It's really impressive for the audience that if you can just have like rattle off a couple of things when something does go wrong or something. Like, I think that's why crowd work clips are so popular at the moment, because although jokes are, to me, the bread and butter of the job, like that, if you need a set in a way, you can't, obviously people do crowd work, but that's after, I think you need to be doing comedy for at least 10 years before you could just walk on stage and be like, right, I'm just going to talk to the audience for an hour and I know it will be funny.
Yeah.
Like, that's crazy.
Yeah, I actually did my first MC gig last week.
How was it?
It went really, really well. I really enjoyed it. I look back on the night though and I go, I forgot to say this, I forgot to say that, I forgot to mention this, you know. And you get kind of caught in the rabbit in the headlights big time, I think, when you kind of realize as an open mic comic, you go on stage, if you do your 5 minutes and it doesn't go well, there's always somebody after you that's going to do 5 minutes and it could go better. So yeah. you don't ruin a night. But I think as an MC, there's two schools of thought that I've kind of come up with, or I've noticed, is that you, if things aren't going well, you have the get out of jail free card. You can just introduce an act.
Yeah.
But then there's, you also feel an added pressure to know that if you do something really bad that just doesn't hit and the room just dies, you've affected the next person that's coming on stage.
Yeah.
And you potentially
could derail the whole thing.
Yeah. Without realizing it. But it, I guess it does, it also does depend on the act, because I'm still so early in this stage where I still use far too many words.
Yeah.
My brain starts going and starts running away. My mouth's saying these things. And as soon as my comes out of the mouth, the brain's gone, what the fuck did you say that for?
You're just feeling silence of nerves, isn't it?
Yeah, like, that's exactly what it is. And I introduced somebody and I went, I've seen this guy before and he's pretty good.
Pretty good. He's pretty good, actually. You'd be surprised. He doesn't look it.
And he came on and he said, I've never been bigged up that way. And if it's going to be that much of a bigging up, this could go very badly. And it was brilliant because it worked.
Yeah.
But as I said it, I was like, what the fuck are you doing?
It's pretty good. I feel like as well, like, well, you know, I get that as well. I'll just, especially if I'm doing new material, if I've forgotten the lead up to a new bit, I will just keep talking and be like, there's a punchline in here somewhere. La, 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 la.
Yes.
But slowing down is always what I've been told anyway. I mean, it's easy to say it. It's hard to do it when you've got all those people going like looking at you and you going, I'm actually going to step back quietly. And in my head, it's going to be 9 hours that I haven't spoken. But in reality, it's been about 10 seconds.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's just keep like say less is more and all that jazz, I suppose.
Yeah, well, you saw me at Loose Laughs, what, a month ago?
Was that a month ago already?
It was something like that, wasn't it? Yeah. I got to the end and went, none of this is going to make sense because I've forgotten a bit in the middle.
No, you just forgot a little bit at the beginning, that's all. But you made it work. It was funny. It was still, because I've seen that happen as well, like so many times with other comics where they'd be like, just about to start a bit and be like, by the way, this won't make any sense because I forgot to mention something about 10 minutes ago.
Yeah.
But let's pretend that I did say something and you found it really funny. Like there's, that could be quite a charming way out of it, I suppose. Ultimately, you're letting the audience into the inside baseball of the whole thing, which audiences love as well. There's a reason why there's such like DVD. Oh my God, how old am I? But like behind the scenes shit on TV, that's always really popular. Audiences are fascinated with how stuff is made.
Yeah.
And I think that's the difference in open mic, right? The audiences are weird in the sense that they could have not known, especially some of the gigs in London, they could have just gone out for a drink with their friends and suddenly comedy is happening at them.
Yes.
And so they're not the greatest audience. And sometimes, but unless it's like places like that have quite a good, like continuing people turning up all the time.
Yeah.
Comedy nerds love knowing, oh, that bit that you did last week, it's kind of evolving a bit this way. And that type of stuff is crazy to know that people are listening in on that. Because so much of that stuff happens just up here, the editing process. To know that someone's like in your own brain, effectively, and like kind of cheering you on, that's amazing.
Yeah.
But yeah, so the normal stand-up audience, open mic audiences, they tend to be a bit less forgiving. But what did they expect if they walked in, if they were having a pub lunch and I don't know, Al Murray, Billy Connolly and Bill Hicks walked in, would they still be like, well, fucking hell,
yeah,
just trying to have my lunch, you know? It's like, you know, different shit.
So we've done the best or your favorite moment on stage. What about
the worst?
Yeah,
all right. So I alluded to this, what I mentioned before about the old guy that turned up early for the book club. That was bad, but it wasn't the worst. I think it's all a matter of what you did last. Like, and that balances on the badness of the gig that's coming, I think. So, for example, I had this bit, and I think you might have heard it, about the bath. If I mention a bath, do you kind of, like, does it ring any bells?
Not at the moment.
All right. So I have a bit about a bath, and it involves masturbation, right? Nothing to do with Saltburn. Still haven't seen Saltburn. Thank you very much. I'm sure it's great. I'm sure it's great. But it was. But I have this bit about masturbating in a bath, and it was the first bit I've written where I felt like I was genuinely taking the audience on a journey, in the sense of like, hold my hand, I'm going to take you through this disgusting idea, but I promise you're going to laugh at the end.
Yeah.
And the first couple of times I did it, it worked, and I was surprised, but it worked. And people were making noises in the audience, which I loved, like, oh, God, yeah, no, stop. And like all of that, which I really enjoy. And there's a laugh at the end, it kind of releases all that pressure. I was like, this bit kills. I kind of got a bit... I rested on my laurels a bit, and I had a 5-minute spot at the EDT, East Dulwich Tavern,
yep,
which is an amazing gig for anyone that wants to do it. It's run by Al Jarrett and Mark Salmon. Please go along to it. It's amazing. I just personally got a bit too big for my boots. I thought this shit's going to fucking kill in every room.
Yeah.
And Luke Nixon is there, who is a very good comedian, and Scott Oswald. They were all like, the whole lineup was amazing. Monica was there, and it was like, I was on like third,
yeah,
and I was like, oh, I'm so glad I've got this new bit. I'm going to impress all, not only like the audience going to laugh, but I'm going to impress all these other comics that I respect.
Yeah.
And so there's that as well. And then I walked on stage to, and the audience was fair, but they were also like, they were all right. So it's Dulwich, right? So like, this is a local gig for local people.
Yeah.
Dulwich, for those that don't know, it's quite a posh little area, just south of, southwest of like Brixton. So it's quite, basically white, old. That's the demographic.
Yeah.
I walk on stage, do a bit about, I do a little like warm up joke, titters. I was like, oh, okay, titters. That's weird. Usually that gets a bit more.
Yeah.
And, didn't tell them that. And then I launched into this bit about masturbating in a bath to silence, like not even a groan of, ugh. I would have loved a groan because I could have like jumped on that and done something with it. And I felt sweat dropping down the back of my neck. I felt like my hands was just getting slippery. I was tripping over my words.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, and they weren't being rude. They weren't being impolite. It was just,
yeah,
and talking about this quite, I suppose, embarrassing, vulnerable thing. And I got to the end of the set, but obviously I had like a minute and a half left because I just was like, blah, 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 blah. And so I was like, would you like, or would you rather? Silence. Okay. So I was, because I kind of like nailed my colours to the mast at this point. They've already judged me as being a disgusting guy. So I asked them, would you rather walk in on your parents having sex or one parent masturbating? Silence. Oh, great. I'd rather walk in on one parent masturbating because it's always over a lot quicker. Daddy's. Oh, thank God you're here. I was flattered, don't worry. Silence. And then I left, and you know it's bad when comics that you respect see you and go, because like, I think the longer you do it, the more you kind of, bombing doesn't hurt as much because ultimately the people that you've been doing it with for all that time know that you can make people laugh. You've just had a shit gig, and that happens to absolutely everyone. So it's when you're new to it and you don't have that many friends and you do bomb, it's the worst. Mm-hmm. Like, bombing feels shit when you first start. And I guess when you're selling out venues and you still have a shit gig, that must suck as well, because people have paid fucking money and got babysitters and all that shit. But like when you're first starting, you don't have any friends, it's the worst. And I nearly had a little, like, after that gig, I walked off stage, and in the break, I was like, I could go home. I could go home. And I didn't. And I'm so glad I didn't, because it was like, you forgot about it. And then you watched other people's go on stage and kill it and be great. And you just got to have a laugh about your failure in a way with peers that get it. And it's not like you can't talk to your friends that don't do comedy about, isn't it awful when you want to kill yourself for doing your hobby? Because it's just like, obviously to me, it's more than a hobby, less than a job. I want it to be a job. But like at this stage, I can't really call it more than that at the moment. Amateur, open mic comedian, I suppose.
I do think you just brought up quite an interesting thought, really, is when you talk about when you bomb, but you still stick around and you watch other people. I think you have to be in this mindset. And I'm not quite there yet, but I guess it comes after time, is that you have to turn your brain off to forget about what you've done.
Mm.
Because what I've done before is when something hasn't gone well for me, and I'm sat there in the audience and watching other people, and I'm going, What have they said that's different to what I've done that's made that audience really laugh? But what I said just got nothing. Was it the delivery? Was it the punchline? Was it how they staggered it? And you start overanalyzing things. And I think you then have to realize that, hold on, I need to stop overanalyzing, but it might be the case of that I just read the room wrong.
Especially like if you're new to it, like if you've been doing it less than a year, like the more that you get on stage, the more you can judge that. And the more that you're kind of, because when you first start, you're like walking into a room and there's strangers there and you know that you're about to stand in front of them. And so your brain just kind of goes, and there's so many things you might miss out about being able to laugh about. Someone's got a dog in the audience. You might not even notice that. Weird noises happening outside. What does the room look like? Has the MC said something that you could jump off of? When you first start, you're so like got the blinders on so thick and fast that you can't relax. Yeah. And the more relaxed you are, the more you can kind of feed off the energy of the audience. So you're matching the audience when you go on stage rather than going, I've got my set to do, I'm just going to do my set.
Yep.
And because you could just come on a million miles an hour, or if the audience is really egged up and you come on quite chilled out, which can work more often than not than the other way around. But, you know, it's just the more you do anything, the better you get at it.
Yeah. Oh, 100%. And it I think it's so crucial. I know you don't always get that luxury, especially if you're really early on in the lineup, but you should always be looking around at what other people said and what's going on in the audience whilst other people are on stage, because you can feed off it and you make that night unique for that audience.
Yeah. Do you know Callum McKenzie?
Yes.
Yeah. So he, I love Callum. I think he's been going for about the same time as us, but he's a machine. He can just do gig. I need some time off, but he's just a machine. But he's amazing at doing that in the room stuff.
Mm.
And you see him walk in and you'll be sitting at a table with a bunch of comics. And then Callum walks in with a notepad and pen already out, just tapping his pen on his notepad, walking around the room, trying to make notes about stuff he can say.
Yeah.
And that's just someone whose brain is never off with that. And Scott Oswald is another one that does that as well. He'll just sit there and be like, hey mate, how's it going? And then he'll just be writing before he's on stage. And then he leaves the stage and carries on writing. I'm like, relax, have a drink. But so it's just, you know, I think different comics have their different approach to it as well. But I feel like, yeah, any moment, anything that you can give the audience that's special to that one night.
Yeah.
I think as well, that's why crowd work works so well these days as well. But anything that makes it unique to them is ultimately going to make them think you're better as a comic and make it unique as well.
Yeah, I think it's, I can only kind of draw on own experiences with this stuff, but even if it's just one line, that one line in 5 minutes can make the world of difference in a really bizarre way. Because I used to have a part in my set which was about my name spelt like by a Frenchman.
Mm.
And I spoke about being trying to go into a hotel in Paris and trying to speak French.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a French girl at the back of the room. And before I even said anything, I shouted to her. I said, I apologize for what you're about to say. I'm about to butcher your language.
Right.
And I went through it and I did it. And she shouted out, no, that was very good, actually. And it was just, it was kind of like it had that connection, but because she was at the back of the room, it kind of went through everyone else,
right?
And it was a really nice feeling, and it kind of felt like it gave me a little bit of a free pass for the rest of the set in a weird kind of way.
It literally opened the room up to you.
Yeah So I do think that's a huge tip for anybody. If there's just one little thing that's not offensive to anyone, but just brings somebody else along the journey, once one person wants to jump on the bus, others are willing to jump on a bus. It's like it's the nervous laughter when you tell a joke in a room and all it needs is that one person to laugh for everyone else to go, oh, it's okay to laugh at that.
Yeah, but they're at a comedy night. Like, surely they would have guessed by now, you know?
You know what it's like. You get to a sensitive topic.
And yeah, it's just like, true. You mention certain things, it just makes people go, but, you know, it's sucky. Sometimes they are just waiting for that, like, one person needs to do one big belly laugh and then they all can.
Yes.
It's bizarre. And sometimes, though, on the antithesis of that is when you get very drunk hecklers who one talks loudly at you so they all think they can. Yep. And you're just like, I can't do my material now. I just have to talk to you. That's the only thing you want. And that's the only thing I can do. Because yeah. if I don't, you'll just talk over me.
Yeah.
Which is like forced crowd work is never fun.
No.
When you're like, okay, fine. This is the way that we're going. let's just try our best here. Yeah.
So you've created your own split bill show before, haven't you?
Yes, I have indeed. I've done it once and hoping to do it again in Edinburgh this year.
So I know this might be a bit cliched, but this is actually something that we've not really spoken about on the podcast so far. Is what goes into doing that, and how does the idea come about? But I bet, yeah, how do you decide this is something I'm going to try? What makes you think you're going to do it? And then
The idea of a split bill specifically, or just a longer show?
Or just a longer show. And maybe taking comfort in being a split bill, I guess.
Okay, well, I feel like the first time I did it was in Brighton with an act called Tom Ratcliffe, who lives up in Luton. He's had a kid about a year ago now. So he's doing a lot of stuff online, but he's trying to do more gigs in London and things. He's really good. But yeah, so it came out of just wanting to be able to do a longer set. I've done fives and tens and 15s and weird with things like sevens and eights. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to, because I know that when you are a professional comic, like the smallest amount you'll do if you're gigging around the country is 20 minutes.
Yeah,
and so I kind of wanted to get my foot in a bit of the door with the clubs, and so just to prove that I can do 20 minutes. I was quite lucky. He just messaged me saying that he's going to Brighton Fringe. He doesn't have an hour, and I didn't have an hour, but I had about 20, 25 minutes. He had about 25 minutes.
Yeah.
And it was only one night, and it was just literally, we didn't really feel, it was nerve wracking because 20, 25 minutes on stage for the first time, just you is like, but I just knew I needed to at some point try that. And so Tom and I, it was just one night, as I say, and there wasn't like, we weren't thinking, oh, and tomorrow night we've got to sell more tickets. It was none of that. It was just this one night in Brighton for the festival.
Yeah.
Split bill. He went on, I went on first, he went on second. And it was just an opportunity to like practice being on stage for that long. And then after that, I don't know what the best way to say in terms of like, was your question like wanting to do it or how do you do it? How do you do it? It was, it kind of fell into my lap, really. That was it. I mean, but you can apply. And surprisingly enough, I tried this as well, like with Hastings Comedy Festival as well. You can, like, there's a website called Comedy Festivals in England. So it's on Chortle or something like that. Yeah. And you essentially just find all the festivals and find out when the applications open. And you could just say, I can do this much time. And it's a lot easier than you think it is.
Okay.
It seems like the only thing that's complicated to me is more the Edinburgh stuff. But if you're not doing the free fringe stuff, there's just so much more admin involved and, you know, wanting to get a good spot and all this stuff. But if you're doing free fringe, yeah, there's that pressure to get a good spot and all that. But so much of it is I'm just sending off this application into the ether and hoping I get something back. So much of it is out of your control anyway. However, if you are working towards like a longer show anyway, there's so many fringe festivals in London. There's the Balham Fringe, Camden Fringe, Brighton Fringe, Edinburgh Fringe. But there's loads of little ones. Tunbridge Wells now has a fringe. So and you can just, once you've got a long set, even if it's an hour or 45 minutes and you're like, I want to get this as good as it can, you can just apply to them. And like, if you know that if they've seen that you've done this before at another festival, they'll probably be more keen to get you on. However, I messaged Hastings and they said, is this going to be your first long set? And I said yes, and they were like, well, that's amazing, we'd love to help with that. I unfortunately can't do it though because I'm busy on the date, which is really annoying, but they took so long to get back to me. So that's another thing that's annoying. You kind of have to keep all your dates fucking free,
yeah,
just in case, because you can't, once they go, we could book you on this day, and you're like, well, I've made plans now, I've got to work or something. So I just don't want a job anymore.
I think that's actually that kind of segues a little bit into the open mic circuit, is that when you're applying for certain nights and stuff like that, I'm always conscious about. I've got a diary of, and I literally write in it what dates I've applied for with whichever promoter, and yeah. I'll never put two in the same day, because I never want to be in that situation where both come back and go, yes, I'm like, shit,
yeah,
I can't.
Well, this is the thing. It's like, that's a very London-centric thing. You have to stay for the whole gig, which makes sense, and it does in a way in this city. But it's like, if we were in New York, that wouldn't be an issue.
No.
you could just, they encourage you to go and do it, because like you're supposed to spend 10,000 hours doing something to get good at it. And if you're doing it 5-minute increments every other day, it's going to take you a lifetime. So as much as I appreciate the idea of bring it and stay at gigs, I really wish that London would adopt more of a New York model of there's going to be an audience. Don't worry. You just come do your thing and then leave, because you've got other ones to do. And so I've only managed to triple up gigs in Edinburgh. I've not been able to do it in London yet, just because it's just like, well, you've got to bring someone and stay for the whole show. And so it's like, and it does. I've seen comics that do it and stuff. Obviously, they've probably been doing it a little bit longer than me, so they're a bit more trusted in the industry in terms of being able to bring the goods. But yeah, it's just, if I could change one thing about the London circuit, it would be that. It's just, we need to adopt a bit. And there's so many open mics, and so many of them happen in pubs. And because so many happen in pubs, you may have noticed this, there's now a lot of comedy nights do two gaps rather than one. Instead of the first and the second half, they'll have three parts.
Yeah.
And that's purely because the pub needs people to buy alcohol.
Yeah.
And so you need to be able to stay so that you could buy more alcohol for the venue, so the venue can keep having the comedy night going. So it's this cyclical thing, which I feel like in New York just doesn't happen. And in New York, they have things like two drink minimums. So you can't come, you have to have already spent the money on two drinks.
Yeah.
Once, as part of the entrance in, and you do have to pay more entrance. You don't have to in a lot of the London gigs, but there's a lot of donations at the end. Not many people donate to them anyway, which is a shame. But you'll get more people donating if they stay. So it's like this thing of, we're kind of like at loggerheads really with it.
It's it's a tough one, because the whole, there's so many nights out there, but so many of these nights are full with the comedians. The lineups are full, but no comedian wants to turn up at a night to end up performing in front of another set of comedians
that have heard all your jokes before yesterday.
And that some of them, to be fair, like some of the more experienced ones, they are there to do their bit, and they're there to go home.
Mm.
They're not there to sit there and learn. And then you get those that are quite new to it, like I've been at the start, and you kind of get to a venue and you see six great acts before you go on.
Mm.
But you can't remember a thing about them, because you're just shitting yourself about what you're going to say in your practice. So there's no... It's the bringer thing is such a, I think every comedian, especially within the London circuit, understands why they exist.
Yeah.
Wishes they didn't exist. But if they didn't exist, ultimately, that night probably wouldn't be able to go ahead.
Exactly. It completely makes sense. It's just a necessary thing at this stage, I think. But you know, I'm trying to do less, but obviously that would mean that I just don't do as many gigs in a month, for example, which is a pain, because I like doing it. It's just having to find someone it's just a whole rigmarole of it all, and like you run out of like normal friends that don't do comedy pretty quickly because they're just like, but it's 3 hours. Yeah. You're like, yeah, on a Tuesday night. What? And it's just like trying to justify that to them is always a bit hard, but who knows. That's why I always feel like there's not many comedy nights that happen on Friday and Saturday nights, because they're all for people going dancing and drinking and watching music, whereas comedy always tends to happen during the week. Which is always a bit funny. It's just something I've noticed. It's like a weekday cheeky thing. You go down, have a couple of drinks, and hear some blue material.
So you mentioned Edinburgh.
Mm.
So is that happening this year then?
I'm still waiting to hear back. It's another split bill. So basically, I was up there last year. I went up for 10 days and I was staying with a friend. So free accommodation, stupid not to go, to be honest. And the accommodation is, well, staying with my friend in Stirling, he told me 5 minutes from Edinburgh. I was like, amazing. All right, sick. Oh, God, nice. And so, and I looked on the map. I was like, I don't know. It's Scotland's not a big country. I reckon that could be 5 minutes. As the months went on the lead up to it, he was like, yeah, it's about 10 minute drive, about a half hour train. What? And then it's an hour train from Stirling to Edinburgh. The last train from Edinburgh to Stirling is at like 10:30. And so many of these, and if you're not going up with anything to Edinburgh, which I do recommend, if you've got the money and you're not like going to bankrupt yourself by going, and if you don't have a show, that means just there's no pressure. And if you just want to know what it's like to do 10 gigs in a day and you'll get good and you'll meet people. So lots of people say there's no point going until you've got until you're a professional. There's some truth in that, but there's also something to be said about just rocking up and just running all over town trying to get, it's fun, you know?
Yeah.
And so I went up with nothing, stayed an hour away from Edinburgh, took the train in every fucking day, and from like 9 a.m. till like the last train, that's all I could do. But like I would just be walking around and I'd find with other friends like Tom Cousins. I think you met at the one we did at Loose Laughs, Tom Cousins.
Yes.
And me and him were just walking around and we just found things to do. We found like panel shows. I was like, okay, when are you going back? Oh, you're going back on that day. Well, I could fit you on this day and you'll be... So I found a panel show and we walked into this pub and we said to the guy, it's like, is there any like compilation shows? That's the word you're going to look for, compilation shows. It's basically an open mic in Edinburgh. Yep. And any compilation shows? No, but this guy over there, he does a panel show. This guy over here, yes. Walked over to this guy. Hey, what's this panel show you're doing? Oh, so essentially... it's a game we play with the audience. We're doing it on this day, which one can you do? I was like, that one. He was like, brilliant, you're going to be on stage with Mark Watson. I was like, what? And so it's like shit like that can happen. And yeah. So like it was an amazing opportunity. But then you find the more you're there that there's places that have specific like monster comedy run by Masai Graham and his wife Kirsty Munro. And who was lovely, and we get to the Dropkick Murphys pub in Edinburgh, and there's like 10 shows a day, and they're all at different hours, and they all have different themes.
Yeah.
And you just rock up and be like, oh, can I do 5? And they're like, yeah. And then you do that, and you come back the next day, and they're like, you were great, you could do 10. And so it's like, and then you do a bunch of those in the day, but then after like 11 p.m., shit gets real, and like you can do like there's awful like. I say awful just in terms of like what you go through as a comedian,
yeah.
Like just like horrible rooms that start at 1 a.m. and there's a famous gong show that starts at like midnight, and like there's all of this stuff, and you just get to meet people that are on the same journey as you but from different areas of the UK because so yeah. much of it is London centric. Anyway, I was doing all this stuff in Edinburgh, and then my friend John, who I'd known for ages, who is an amazing comic, John Hipkiss from Birmingham, he's been doing it for about 10 years consistently, a bit of a technophobe, not a technophobe, he's not on the socials as much, which mm-hmm. which annoyingly is kind of what you need yep. in this kind of day and age. But I was friends with him from ages ago, and we were at the National Youth Theatre together.
Ooh.
2 weeks of just fucking around in a student union, really. And it's true. And then I knew he was doing stand-up, and I knew he was going to be in Edinburgh doing his show. And so I was just walking down the road and I saw him. And he was like, hey, come over. And I was like, nice. He goes, what have you got? Have you got a show up? I was like, no, I don't. And he said, I do. I was like, that's great. He goes, do you want to open for me? Sure. And yeah. I was like, well, how long are you here for? And I was like, I was here for until the 16th. And he was like, do you want to just open for me while you're here? So then I had a regular gig. And yeah. shit like that can happen. So, and especially if you're going up and you know people up there as well, somebody might get ill, somebody might not feel up for it. So you can just kind of jump on doing little segments here and there. So yeah, it's an amazing place. You'll lose weight through stress and all sorts of stuff, and everything's uphill, so
yeah,
it's really annoying. And as I said, I was very lucky. I had free accommodation for like 10 days, so that's all I did. So hopefully this year in Edinburgh, John and I are going to be doing a split bill. So we'll be doing about 20-25 minutes on stage with some sort of theme around some sort of panel kind of game show aspect as well. Still waiting to hear back. It might not happen. Art.
Fingers crossed.
Thank you.
Yeah, the one thing I found about Edinburgh, I went last year just as a punter, I didn't do any gigs or anything, was that when you get to the top of a hill, you're just at the bottom of another one.
Mm-hmm.
And it just, it feels relentless. Your calf muscles have never worked so hard in all it's their ridiculous. Life, no matter what sport you've ever done.
Yeah, and the only food up there kills you. So it's not like, it's true. It's like everything's layered in fat and it's so good, but it's like you're doing constant exercise and replacing it all with fat, not protein. So it's just, it's an amazing place.
Yeah, it's the one thing that... Well, there's two things that shocked me. Was number one was how expensive accommodation is. So be prepared for that.
Mm-hmm.
Book as well in advance as you can, and book if you can get a cancellation, even better.
Yeah.
But the other thing that shocked me was how reasonable the prices were for everything else.
Yeah.
Drinks in bars. And you think, I don't know if it's coming from like the London side, is they go, oh, we put an event on. Prices go up. Every pint's an extra £1.50 or whatever.
Right.
There was just... I'm in the middle of a massive comedy tent with God knows how many rooms that are putting on shows, and you go up to the bar and it's like, yeah, 2 pints of whatever, and they go like, yeah, it's £8. Like, what?
Yeah.
What, each? No, just together.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And you just buy some food and it's just like from a food truck or something, but it's
good food and it's cheap. And I think it's like it's a student town, Edinburgh.
Yeah.
So they're used to that kind of what's it called? They're used to that thing, you know, a lot of people turning up and wanting to drink.
Yeah.
It's the same with Brighton. With London, though, it's just you have to get a mortgage if you want a G&T. It's a bit much. But yes, the accommodation is astronomical. And I think that's just because Edinburgh is the biggest arts festival in the world.
Yeah.
And they already, it's built for accommodating lots of people. So it makes sense that they, I don't necessarily if they hike the prices up for the festival, but I know people
they do.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Okay. Fair. But it's, and that's the thing. It's kind of, I wouldn't say it's getting, Edinburgh's getting gentrified in a way. And that's it. Just the festival. I mean, it's just, but it is getting ridiculously, like it's becoming one of those things that unless you're quite well off, it's you really, really have to think about whether or not it's worth doing. Because if you have a bad year, it'll fuck up your next whole year.
Yeah.
And there was a comic from Germany, I think, last year in Edinburgh, who was at the Tonic, one of the venues. He had a whole month booked in. He ended up doing a week and a half and then going, I'm losing money every day. And he had to stop and go back, which that's the first I ever heard happening at the Edinburgh Festival. Acts having to not do it. And that's the thing, it's Edinburgh. You might do a full room, you might do a room to one person.
Yep.
That's just the way the festival goes, especially in the first couple of weeks, you know.
Yeah, I found the first couple of weeks were probably the cheapest weeks in terms of accommodation. But when I boil it down to... I paid the equivalent of £280 a night.
Jesus.
In a Premier Inn.
Fuck.
And you walk in and go, so where's the swimming pool?
Yeah, exactly.
There's no swimming pool. This is a Premier Inn. You're like, I've just paid £280 a night.
Mm.
Oh, you do get some breakfast. The breakfast was nice, but it wasn't, you know.
It was worth £280 a night.
And that was the cheapest I could find that would have been within Edinburgh. I mean, I was in Edinburgh Old Town.
Yeah.
But I was near the train station, so... I had everything on my doorstep, and I guess you're paying for that convenience. But when you go, okay, we've done 4 nights there, and it's cost us the best part of £300 return on a train.
Yeah.
And then you look at what you spent on the food and drink, which I said is extremely reasonable. And you go, we just booked our summer holiday to somewhere nice and warm for less than what 4 days in Edinburgh cost.
Yeah.
I mean, something's wrong.
I mean, I love that festival, but at the same time, it's we're living in a world now where people can put comedy specials up on YouTube.
Yeah.
Like, it's the gatekeepers are slowly kind of falling away.
Yes.
And whether or not that's a good or a bad thing, because there is like a... I mean, the cream always rises to the top. So if you're good and you know you're good and you want to keep doing this and make a career out of it, that will be obvious compared to someone who's just managed to put an hour video up on YouTube.
Yeah.
But, you know, I feel like it's... I love that festival. I really want it. It's just... Yeah, no. Who knows? We're having an election this year. Maybe things will change in terms of they won't have to make the prices so dear because cost of living will go down and all that jazz. And other funny things to talk about. but yeah, it's just, yeah, it's difficult.
Yeah. I'd always say to people is go at least once just to see it. I mean, I'd never been until last year and I'd never been that. Say never been that into comedy. My comedy history was always what you saw on the television.
Mm.
It was never the grassroots level until I got involved in it, and then getting involved with it, and you see it, and then you realise you're walking around in Edinburgh seeing absolutely anything and everything. It becomes like a complete overload in your mind and trying to can I get to see that? Can I leave this venue on this time to get to this one to see this and then see this and then see this?
Yeah.
The one thing I'll always say is go with another comedy fan. Never go with somebody who likes a little bit of comedy because they'll burn out and they'll not be interested after a couple of days. They'll be like, I can't do another one. I just can't.
Yeah. it's a weird thing. It's a weird thing that kind of wanting to see as much as possible. But then again, I get their point of view. You just need to bring someone who's mad instead, shall we? Who's willing to starve and be dehydrated just to sit in a room
for
the people. It's a crazy thing.
Cool. So what about jokes then? We kind of touched on it before then.
Yes.
Your favourite or best, whichever one you class as what you want to talk about, joke, about?
Yeah, so I have a favourite joke and it's not one I've written, but it's just my favourite joke. And people have heard it before. And I think if someone is to go, Sam, what type of comic are you? This is my level of humor. This is what I love. Why did the girl fall off the swing?
Don't know.
Because she had no arms. I just love that joke so much. I don't know why. There's so much imagery that falls into your head. How did she get on the swing? Is someone pushing her? But so like it's stuff like that where it's kind of like wrong thoughts comedy. I always love. Now, in terms of a joke that I've written that I like is the snowman joke, and I'm fully aware the snowman is something that is very Britain centric. Like I can't go to America and be like, hey, so there's this cartoon that we have at Christmas, and essentially, snowman. For those that don't know, little boy builds a snowman, has fun with it, and flies around the world, flies around the village, and he wakes up the next morning and it's melted. So that's the snowman. My joke was, has anyone ever seen the snowman? Some of you, yeah. We're walking in the air, yeah. I don't like that cartoon. It doesn't make any sense to me. I don't believe it. I think it's far-fetched. because firstly, we all know snowmen can't fly. Also, I've never seen a ginger kid make a friend that quickly. And that was just one of those jokes that it just kind of fell in. And it was because being ginger as well, it's like, I know I can say that joke.
Yeah.
But I've definitely heard other comics who aren't ginger make anti-ginger jokes.
Yeah.
But it's like, it's the last bastion of things you can take the piss out of, I suppose, in terms of just physical appearance. Mm-hmm. it's an interesting thing, but it's one of those ones that it just struck a chord on so many levels. The idea of of course the ginger kid's imaginary friend dies of embarrassment, you know. It's just it feels mine because of the whole ginger thing, but everyone knows about this story and sometimes they don't even remember that the kid is ginger, but watch that video again, he is. And there's also like a whole other element to that where I said that on stage and someone's like, by the way, did you know that there's like a prequel to The Snowman? And it's David Bowie goes up into his attic and he finds a scarf and a hat, and he's like, I remember when I had a snowman. And then it walks into the snowman, and it's like, apparently what? The little kid's David Bowie. Oh, yeah. My God. Yeah. So
in terms of that joke, or that sequence of jokes, how's it, has it changed, or was it literally that lightning bolt and it's pretty much stuck? Or
it's pretty much stuck. I've tried to fiddle around with it just because you get bored, but like I tried to get rid of, we all know snowmen can't fly. I just launch into the whole I don't trust that joke because I've never seen a ginger kid make a friend that quickly.
Yeah.
Sometimes I always find that, I mean, I always like the economy of words, trying to get as streamlined as possible, but I don't know whether it's a bit of a safety blanket for me of kind of going with the audience. Like, we all know snowmen can't fly. Get them to nod at least and be like, yeah, okay. And this thing that's horrible that you haven't thought of. And yeah, so it's kind of like taking with one hand and giving with the other,
yeah,
in that sense. I've tried it without that. It does work, but it just feels a bit too quick,
yes,
for people, especially if they're not ready to hear something anti anything. Because some people still get tense about that stuff. I've tried to say it where I've never seen a ginger kid make a friend, and then let's leave it as that. And that always, yeah, kind of feels like people are a bit going, ugh. It's kind of like when you stall your car a bit. But
yes,
sometimes it feels like it does need that extra thing to make it less terrible for the people, to make it a bit more palatable, which, yeah, I don't like. It's kind of pandering to the audience a bit, but I don't know how to tread that line yet. I'm still kind of fresh, because I want to make them laugh, but I also I don't want them to, and to do that you kind of need to make them feel safe to laugh. So I don't know, it's a fine line. I don't, obviously all comedy courses say don't pander to the audience, but I don't know if that is pandering or if that's just setting up a structure of a joke that definitely gets a laugh.
I don't think that's pandering. I look at that as a sometimes I look at certain jokes and there's two hand gestures. The snowmen don't fly is a shake of the hand, and then mm-hmm. ginger kid is a slap around the face.
Yes, okay,
it's,
cool.
It's got that.
It's a verbal slapstick.
Yeah, without okay. the shake of the hand, you haven't lulled that audience into not being prepared.
Mm. And a lot of people love the snowman, because I remember saying on certain gigs, oh, do we all remember the snowman? Yeah, we remember. I hate that cartoon. Oh, and you don't want to go too far down. I get awes a lot. Whenever I spoke about being bullied as well on stage, there's a lot of, oh, and it's like, oh, it's like, I'm fine. You don't need to feel sorry for me. And that's what I've like, when you do it a lot and you make friends in the circuit as well, when you come off stage, I remember Greg Houston said something really poignant to me, which is something I just never considered. But I was doing a bit that was a bit mean, essentially. I was kind mm-hmm. of taking the piss out of something, and I was saying quite dark stuff, and it wasn't getting any laughs. And I came off stage and I was like, you know, man, it just didn't do it. And he was like, and Greg just turned around and said, it's because people, like, they see you and they immediately like you. You don't have to, and because, and you look, I'm only 5'6", 5'7". I'm quite thin. And so like people immediately think, boy, little boy, they do. And it's like something that I hadn't even thought about. So when they see that and they see this kid, and most of my jokes are not incredibly dark anyway, they're just silly. I love silliness. Yep. And so they could get on board. But if I suddenly turn around and say something, I swear in real life all the time, I try not to, and it comes out on stage a lot, and I really try not to, because I know that when I do, it makes some people go,
yeah,
you shouldn't do that. And as much as that's like, that's, I suppose, as, at the end, as I get older, that will change. But it's like the audience kind of sees you as a thing, and if you betray that thing,
yep,
they don't know what to make of you, so they don't know if they can laugh at you anymore, even though the fact that they're at a comedy night should be pretty obvious.
Yes.
But yeah, so it's like he just said, like, it's because people see you and they immediately like you, which is something that I had never considered. I'm a good boy in their kind of frame of reference, in a way. No, they prefer the tongue-in-cheek stuff rather than the wanking in a bath kind of stuff, essentially. They like a little bit of play about the snowman.
Now, but I'm going to have to cut that.
Okay, fine.
No, it's going to have to be a clip. It's going to, It can't be about the tongue-in-cheek stuff. It's got to be about wanking in the bath.
I'm trying to steer my routine more me, you know? And so that is more me, but it's just having to be a bit more sneaky about it. And maybe that will involve more crowd work, because you need to do that crowd work to get the people to know who you are and stuff like that. Because I feel like with crowd work, you can create an atmosphere.
Yes.
Quite quickly. Really. Yeah. Be that good or bad, I suppose.
No, I think it's as you get more and more experience with, from doing your fives to the sevens. Sometimes if you go from a five to a seven, you can use a minute of that seven to do some crowd work. But it's always hard to do the crowd work in a five, because inevitably you're under pressure to make sure it is five.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to piss an MC off. You don't want people to nights to drag on too long. So you kind of you do your bit and go kind of thing. But with the extra ones, I think it's always a good idea just to, if you can get something out of it, chuck an extra 30 seconds of stuff with crowds in there. I think it always...
I had a gig last night in Surbiton, a whole lot of comedy. It's great. Elaine and Elaine, who runs it, and her husband, amazing. But I have a bit at the moment, which... you kind of do a bit for a couple of months or a couple of weeks, and you like, I found something with it. But I ignored the fact there was such an opportunity to invite the crowd into it, because I'm talking about names, different types of names. And the setup is like, I want to change my name. I want to change my name to something a bit more strong. And like, for the first time last night, I was like, has anyone else ever thought that they wanted to change their name? Silence. One girl nodded, like shook her head, and was like, no. I was like, what's your name then? And she was like, I think she said Laura. And I was like, you could change that. Got a bit of a laugh, but it's like something that I'd never even considered, that there's a whole wealth of opportunity to build something in amongst that to then get to the punchline. So it's like sometimes bits within stuff you think are dead, like, you know, they work, but they're dead to you in the sense that you've kind of flogged them to death. Like a horse, flogging a dead horse.
That's the one.
And then realize actually there's some still life in this horse if you just kind of take the blinkers off, ironically, kind of look around the room a bit more, around like opening up the avenue to talk to people.
Yeah, no, I 100% with you on that one. So there's a little fun question to chuck in for the moment is, so things going well, Edinburgh smashes, BBC come knocking. We want you to do an Apollo set.
Yeah, okay.
But you've got to pick your, what music would you like to walk on the stage to?
My first thing that came into my head was When the Levee Breaks by Led Zeppelin.
Okay.
It's just got that really heavy, like drum bit. And then it comes on with the guitar. I just feel like I don't know what it is. I love drums, percussion anyway. I used to learn the drums. It's just something that does, something about heavy drums just makes people go, okay, something's happening. It feels a bit more like an event, I suppose. So I suppose right now, When the Levee Breaks by Led Zeppelin would be my walk-on music. I mean, I can't afford them. Like, no, it's never going to happen.
Know.
True, you never know. But it's something like drums... Drum heavy is what I'd usually go to. Because like I was listening to a podcast with Jimmy Carr, and he says that 92 BPM is good music to play in the auditorium before you come out. Because that's apparently 92 BPM is how stand-up shows usually are. They usually it's that kind of rhythm.
Yeah.
It's a good comedy rhythm. Obviously not every stand-up comedian adheres to that rule, but... a good rule. If you go on to Spotify, there are just like other song companies are available. But if you go on to them, and if you could just find 92 BPM playlists, and they're all like Radiohead's is a lot of BPM, 92 BPM. Obviously not funniest songs in the world, but there are other ones that are a bit more upbeat that are on 90. And you kind of listen to those and think, actually, it puts you, what that 92 BPM does, it kind of puts you in a headspace where you're alert but relaxed. And that's exactly what you want with comedy. And I feel like, have a little experiment. But like, I don't think When the Levee Breaks is 92 BPM. But I think that would be a nice thing to play just as that all those other songs stop just before you come on.
Yeah.
It's just going to rev it up a little bit, you know.
That's interesting, actually. I never thought about like an ideal, even talking about like beats per minute when you talk about heart rate, in terms of what's a comfortable thing. Because I had this a little while ago. I did Backyard, and I did it with Chris Alley.
Nice.
And he was on first, I was on third, and he'd done his bit, he went and sat down. I'd done my bit, and I went and sat down. And I looked at my watch, which had the beats per minute going. I just showed him, it was like 127.
Yeah.
And I wasn't even on the stage.
Yeah.
I just insane. Come off. And there used to be a, I used to have a watch that would track everything, and then every single day it would give me a graph, like the next day, how things went the day before. And this was when I was doing the comedy course, and you could always see it had like a stress level thing. When you got to like 7 o'clock in the evening, it was like up, flat line, 9 o'clock, down.
Yeah.
And it was just like that.
And you wonder why so many comedians have issues with like drugs and alcohol. It's like when you what can you do when your heart is like, and it's 10 o'clock at night? Like, what can you do to calm down? But that's why, like, sticking around. For an argument for staying is that you get to hang out afterwards with all the acts. And I think so you learn so much about the industry that way. You learn about other gigs that might be going on as well.
Yes.
Just by chatting, just the hangout afterwards is almost just as important as doing the actual work in a way. And even if little things like, especially if you're brand new and you're quite fresh on the scene, ask the MC at the end of the gig, is there anything I can do to help put things away? If you get there early, can I help set things up? They'll just remember you. It's so, and ultimately you'll learn how to set up a mic stand. Like, and it, trust me, it's complicated. Okay.
We've seen the clip.
Sometimes they fall apart, but sometimes as well, like a lot of open mic nights, they have the, and there is a difference. Like if you go to an open mic night and it's literally a bass, a stand and a mic, that is perfect. But you get the ones that are for guitars quite a lot. I don't know why, they're just more out there. And those are just fiddly. And a lot of people, you can kind of tell when someone's not done comedy that long by how they touch a mic stand. And if you're confident in touching a mic stand, it sounds so trivial. But if you're confident about getting a mic out of a stand and putting it down, the audience goes, oh, okay. But you see sometimes, and it's not anyone's fault, but like, newer comics on the scene will tend to get really fiddly, and obviously the mic is, it picks up noise, so it's like blah, 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 blah. That thing that happens in TV shows where you're nervous and the mic goes, that never happens. But for some reason it's like it's all this and they take the mic out of the mic stand and then they leave the mic stand dead in front of them, and it's like, just move it a bit, it's your stage, you get to do whatever you want when you're up there. So yeah, it's little bits like that, but like, I don't know what the question was, but I just went into mic stand technique.
But that's interesting, because it does rewind and kind of gives a bit of a plug for an earlier episode with Jim Hooker.
Okay.
We were talking about kind of this stuff, and he actually bought a stand and a microphone that's in his house, and he just has it in the corner of a room. So you try walking past that and not picking it up.
Yeah.
And by doing that, all he's doing is reinforcing into his memory how to handle that.
Yeah.
So you're actually grabbing it. Because the one thing that I did like a workshop once where they spoke about, I mean, I ask silly questions about things that worry me that will detract from what I want to do. And one of them is how to handle a microphone. And the guy showed us how to take a microphone out the stand, put it to one side, but you never take your eyes off the audience.
Yeah.
And it's such a, you watch somebody else do it and you go, okay, that looks really easy. And then the next time I went up on stage, I've grabbed the mic, I've looked down, I've looked for the stand, and I've moved it to one side, and I've immediately broken eye contact with the audience.
See, it's crazy, isn't it? They're like little tiny things.
Yeah, those things are, if the act that comes on is confident, maintaining that eye contact with people in the room and looking at the room rather than looking at the floor and looking at a stand and trying to work out where to grab it. And you end up with the ones where you try and grab the stand and the microphone at the same time, they get slightly tangled and you're trying to do the twiddly with
that's
it.
The thing. That's like, those are those mic stands with the prongs rather than the base. because you're just like spending ages just twiddling this thing like a like ugh. And the whole audience is like, you can feel the energy going
yeah
as you do it, even though it's like half a second. It just feels like, yeah, so it's crazy. Although I think having a microphone and a mic stand in your flat is a bit weird, but I mean, it's a very smart thing to do, but like if he ever brought someone around for a date for the first time, I think it'd be a bit like, wow, what are you doing?
Yeah, I get
who's
that.
This for? Yeah. I just chuck a coat on it. No one will know. But no, it's cool. It's a good idea. I mean, I at the moment practice with a hairbrush or a can of something.
Yeah.
Because it's just, and it's like sometimes it drives me insane. I need to, before I do a set, especially if I'm doing new material, even if it's material I've done to the Cows Come Home, if I'm doing it, if I know I've got a set that evening, I need to walk around holding something, saying yep. that set before I, it can't be the first time I do it that day is on stage. Even though I've done it till the Cows Come Home, there's just something about getting that into the muscle memory again.
Yeah, it's preparation.
And it's like fucking, because I get really jealous with people who leave it in the stand. I feel like that's so cool. I don't know what it is. There's something about the confidence of just being able to stand there with both hands free, telling a story, and even using the mic stand as a kind of funny thing
yeah.
to like hold. But like, I think my nervous energy, I've managed to do it once when I've kept it in the stand and it went well. And I tried to do it again when I kept it in the stand and then I died on my arse. So it's just like, it's a weird thing. I mean, some people say never touch the mic stand. Lots of people like to lean on the mic stand.
Yeah.
I feel like that's kind of cool, personally. I feel like it makes you look bigger and all of that. As long as it's not in front of you. And some people like to hold it real close. Like yep. even professionals, like Paul Smith, you see sometimes on clips, he's got it. He's got almost like got the mic stand in a headlock.
Yes.
While he's talking. And it's like, that's almost kind of, because it gives like an energy of like aggression in a way, or like you're feeling like vulnerable, so you can hold on to something and fiddle with something.
Yeah.
But some people, and I'm jealous of this, it's usually because I'm quite short, like bigger guys, bigger comedians, bigger women as well. I've seen them where they hold the mic stand, but they lift it up.
Yes.
So it just looks like they're like tirading around the stage. And like Sam Talent, who's an amazing American comic, does that as well. And he's very big. He's like 7'6" or something, but it's like just towering over, like Nick Helm does it as well. I think Pete Kinsella, who was on the podcast, I think, yeah, so I don't know if it's out yet, you might have to cut this out, but he does that sometimes as well, and he just holds the mic stand and leans over the audience. It's just like, oh, it's so cool.
Yeah.
But you can have a lot of fun. I once got a big laugh at the beginning of a gig because the mic wasn't working, but people kept on going up and holding the mic. I was on later on in the evening. I held the mic upside down and spoke into it that way. That got a big laugh, just because everyone knows the elephant in the room is the mic doesn't work.
Yeah.
So just if you fuck around with it and just play around with it that way. And Rick Kiesewetter, American comic, he had a whole bit about mic technique, and the mic was working. You needed it, but it was a small room, so he didn't need it. And he just held it by his side the whole time. And it just, that got a laugh anyway. So, you know, it's weird.
We were at both of that same night.
Oh, yes.
It was a We Are Funny, and yeah, the mic wasn't working. They couldn't find another cable or another microphone or something. And
so he just held it by his side the whole time.
Yeah, you don't need it up here. You don't need it down here. You just don't need it. Whatever.
Yeah.
You know, they can still hear you. Just project. Yeah. And it was almost like getting a workshop lesson in that that night. That
but was it's like quite business. Funny. It's like just having something to do sometimes is funny. But ultimately, that's more of an actory thing, I think,
than a
comedian thing. You kind of need to have you need to say what you have to say.
I think
it's nice to hide behind something as well.
Yeah, I think that night was an interesting one because the mic, I remember because the mic wasn't working. That was the first time I'd done a gig with the mic left in the stand. Because I didn't want, because if
what
you touch
what do you do
it,
with these?
Yeah. Well, this is kind of where I was going with that, is that when you see people leaning on the stand, like one arm on and one up, I was doing that at the start purely because I felt my left hand was then doing something. I'm one of these, I don't know what to do with it. It's just, it's there, it's attached to this body, and it feels like it should be doing something. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So by having it resting on that stand, is it's occupied. I don't have to think about it.
Yeah.
Now I've got a bit more confident in that. I don't quite need that, but occasionally some nights, depending on how it goes, especially if the stage is quite small, I end up finding I gravitate towards leaning on it.
Yeah.
If the stage is a little bit bigger, I'll have a play around. But yeah, the mic technique is just something that comes, but I think it's something that you have to be aware of. And I still, to this day, whenever I look back at any videos that I have recorded, I want to be able to see myself walk up to the stand, grab it in my left hand, grab the mic in my right, pull it out, move it to the left, and then I've not broken eye contact.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the moment I do that, I will celebrate that.
Like, it's a little way. It's kind of like embodying Jesus in a way. Like, it could work. But then again, when you leave the stage, how much of a, you could be the coolest comic that night. But if you go before you leave as well, trying to get it in the mics there, it's crazy. Then again, I'd rather have a cord than a cordless mic.
Yes,
I find cordless mics too light. They're kind of too.
I'm with you on
this.
This
is really nerdy comedy stuff. This is like quite very specific mic technique. But you want a nice heavy grip, and you want it's a crazy one, man. But it's useful. You need it in a way, or you don't. It's up to you. I don't know if like I'd ever do the radio mic one, Billy Connolly style, just like hey, or Michael McIntyre, all that jazz.
You'd have to be so confident with what your hands are doing.
Yeah.
I'd start feeling like a politician where you're trying to do all the gestures and stuff
like
that.
You do find as well, though, like when you're, if you watch your stuff back, I kind of, my hands fall into a rhythm of gesticulating as I'm talking as well anyway. And it's a lot of pointing and stuff, but ultimately I try not to think about it too much unless it's a part of a setup, you know?
Yeah.
But sometimes you see comedians hold the mic like if this is the microphone. Sometimes I've seen comedians hold it like this.
Yeah.
Against their, because obviously they want you to see their face, but I feel like this is still cool. Like you don't need to be up here. Ultimately. But you know, he shall remain nameless. He's very funny. It's just that I saw him do that once and the MC took the piss out of it and now I can't never not see him.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah. That's pretty cool. So I guess we've kind of touched this on this before, is what you like to see change on the circuit.
Yeah, I feel like, as I say, adopting more of a New York, in a perfect world.
Yeah. Oh, this is a dream scenario.
I would like to book more than one gig in a night and not feel like I have to cancel one of them.
Yes.
I'd like to be able to go to more than one gig in a show, and not have a black spot next to your name because you left early.
Yeah.
Although New York does have, as far as I'm aware, they do have bringers, but you have to bring like a lot of people, and that's just for ticket sales. And I think the element of selling tickets is put upon New York and American comics quite early on, whereas with Britain and London, it tends to be you stay for the whole show and bring someone, and that way there is an audience anyway. And we're just trying to keep the venue happy, because a lot of the times the venue and the stand-up night are two very separate things, whereas in New York they tend to be one cohesive thing. And I don't know how much comedy tickets are to go and see comedy in New York. I can't imagine it be astronomical. Being able to practice more and not be chastised for leaving early or not bringing someone, when ultimately I think there's as much as there is like marketing out there for comedy shows, maybe it is just London. Maybe it's just London audiences don't expect. It's stand up is the most disrespected art form out there. People feel like they can interrupt it. You know, it's crazy. But I think because of that, the whole idea of comedy, it's people don't take it seriously because it's comedy. It's the opposite of seriousness. Unless you are a comedian who does take it seriously, people don't really care. Even though it's respected in the sense that, oh, I could never do that. And like people say, oh, well, you must be so brave. It doesn't necessarily mean they want to watch it either. So Yeah, I mean, in a perfect world, I'd like to be able to do 3 gigs a night, 4 gigs a night. And because as well, the London pubs shut at 11.
Yeah.
And other cities in America, they're open all night. So there is, you could do a gig at 3 in the morning, like sometimes. Even though that would be, and obviously because of that, like a lot of the people in the open mic circuit still have day jobs, so they can't physically do that. Or they have family. They have like little kids to get back to, or a significant other that had an evening planned.
Yeah.
And, you know, because you stayed out later to get good at what you want to get good at, obviously those things fall by the wayside. Sometimes, not all the time.
No.
But yeah, I feel like having more of a New York kind of look at the club circuit in London would be interesting. Obviously, as I say, the London circuit has what I'm doing right now, Mark, is covering my tracks in case any promoters watch this and feel like that I'm not giving it all, but I'm just saying, it would be great to do more than one gig in a night and not have that I've let down a promoter
feeling.
Because I've seen other comics, the thing is, the longer you do it, the more of a relationship you build with the people in the industry, the more they're like, I trust you to turn up on time. And yes, you can leave and do something else as long as you then come back and do this, you know? But I feel like the rules are there for a reason as well. Like, when you first start out, like, I think it's good to have those strict rules in place of turn up on time. If you're late, you don't perform. If you don't bring someone, you don't perform, and you have to stay for the whole night to support it. It kind of separates the people that want to take it seriously to the people that kind of just want to try it a couple of times.
Yeah.
And both of those are absolutely valid. I'm not saying you shouldn't ever try it if you don't want to take it seriously. I think those rules make that quite clear that there are people out there that really take this seriously, and you need to bring an audience because otherwise you're yelling into a void.
Yeah.
But once you're kind of over that and the industry knows you a bit better, they kind of take the pressure off a little bit with that anyway. So it does make sense in its own way. But yeah, I just want to do more gigs. That's it.
Yeah. I'm with you on that. I'd never actually thought about it like that, because for somebody like me who travels in from outside London, knowing if I can get 2 or 3 done in a night,
boom,
it's 3 times as many as I'm going to do normally. I know it's obvious maths, but it takes the pressure. At the moment, I tend to only do 1 a week, but then I'll chuck a second in when I think I can get away with it with the family, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's like, okay, yeah, I'm doing 2 this week, but the difference between gig 2 and then the one next week is 8 days. So you kind of buy your time for that. But knowing that I could go into London, I could do night 1 at 7 o'clock. I'd be done by 8, and then I could go and shoot off to somewhere else and then do another, get on stage for 8:30.
Yeah.
And then do another one maybe for 9:30 or 10 o'clock. And then I'm on the train home at 11. That would be amazing.
It would be amazing. And it's also like, it takes the pressure off, because if you're only doing a gig a week and you bomb, that feeling will just carry on. But like, the best cure for a bomb is a good gig. So if you bomb and then do well, you're like, ah, I feel great again.
Yes.
And it's more of a laugh as well, because it's like, oh, that audience was maybe a bit weird, or you were kind of in a weird headspace because you know you were going to do it more than once that night, you know?
Yeah.
So I feel like, the best cure for a bad gig is a good gig. And if something you know didn't work, you don't have to wait a week to try it again. You could just be like, bah, 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 bah,
exactly.
And you ironed out all those creases. In a perfect world, maybe it's in one night. Yeah.
Cool. Okay. I think that's been a quite insightful episode for anybody that's listened. It's been a... There's been a lot of knowledge that's been shared. And this is what this exists for.
Okay, fair enough.
So it's been a lot of fun.
Nice. I've had a great time.
So we're not quite finished yet, because I'd like to bring on the Comedians Challenge.
Yes, what is this?
Yeah, the Comedians Challenge is it's based around a book called The Little Book of Shit Jokes by Sid Finch.
Okay.
I'm challenging every comedian to pick a joke from this book to do in their set. They can either weasel it in carefully how they think they can get it in without making it too obvious, or they can cut and say, I've got to tell this joke for a stupid idiot I've been speaking to, and then we're going to cut at the end. I'd like it to be, if you can, record it and then add us as a contributor on Instagram and then just
yeah,
bit of fun. But you pick your joke by page number, so I don't even know what you're going to get.
How many pages are there?
You can pick any number between 5 and 95.
5 and 95, fuck. Okay. Do I go? Okay, page 19.
19. Has not been taken yet. You've got quite a long joke here.
Fuck. Right, let me grab my pen.
I'll send you a picture of it after. So the joke I want you to tell on stage in front of an audience and have recorded and tag us is, I went to my uncle's house for dinner. How many burgers would you like, he asked. Just one, I replied. Now there's no need to be polite, said my uncle. Oh, okay, just one, you smelly idiot.
All right.
Sorry. Now,
okay, fine.
Caveat is if the joke is the same theme, great. So if you do something about hot dogs rather than burgers in your set, change that. All if right. it's not an uncle, change it to an auntie. Whatever
what
you want to do.
Last, what about the punchline? Can I make it a bit more of a punch up, if you know what I mean? Or can it has to be, what is it, stupid idiot or silly idiot?
Smelly idiot. So yeah, smelly you can change it to something else that's just as insulting.
All right, fucking cunt.
Well, yeah, you could do that one.
All right. Send me the picture. I mean, I'd love a challenge. Why not? I'll give it a go.
I think it's actually interesting because when I give these out to people, sometimes you can see their brain start thinking as like, oh, where can I put this into it? Where could this fit? And I get away with it.
Okay, well, I do a lot of family stuff anyway, so I feel like it will fit in quite nicely.
Yeah, so you've gone to a family's friends for dinner, barbecue in the summer.
Yeah.
Thinks he's a bit of a comedian.
Yeah. Christ. I picked it, I'm stuck with it, I'll do it. Don't know when I'll do it, but I will do it.
Good.
My nephew told me this joke.
You could do it whatever way you want. I mean, when I've spoken to a comedian whose episode will be out just before yours, and they flipped the tables on me. They asked for two jokes, and one of them was what they'd do, and the other joke was what they wanted me to do at their night.
Is that Pete Kinsella?
No.
Oh, fine. No.
Okay, and fine. The annoying thing is my joke begins with, why did the chicken cross the road?
Okay, so I think I know where you're going.
I've got to do a why did the chicken cross the road joke in Camden on a gig I've been waiting a year to get onto.
Oh, Jesus. What's the gig?
Comedy in Your Eye.
Oh, my God. Oh, you'll be fine.
I've worked out how to weasel it in, I think. So nice. But it's interesting how I think every comedian that's been mentioned to has gone on to try it or willing to try it. And there's a couple that still haven't done it yet, but they're like, no, I promise you, I will be doing this.
Yeah, I will be doing this. I mean, it might have a different point of view. It might be from a different perspective.
Yeah.
I've already got a pretty good idea of what it could be.
Good.
But I won't spoil it.
Chris Alley did his one, and then he actually added another joke at the end of it, which was quite nice how he did it. How he brought it in was perfect. He did the joke, and then he basically kind of did a repetition, but a slight deviation on that same joke to keep. So it didn't sit in isolation.
Right. Okay.
It's on the real section of the Instagram profile, so it's worth going back to have a look.
And I'll go and have a look. Yeah,
that's pretty cool.
Yeah, see what you're doing.
So, before we wind up, then what's your socials and everything that people can find you on?
So you can find me on Instagram. I am on Facebook, but I usually only use Facebook for if you want to like look at what I do and where I'm going. Instagram is where you want to go. I'm at Spladamson. That's SPLADAMSON. Might change that, but at the moment that's what it is. I'm on Facebook as well with Sam Adamson, but as I say, I only really use Facebook nowadays to look for gigs and promotions and things like that.
Yep.
But yeah, mainly Instagram. I'm on YouTube as well. If you just type Sam Adamson or the Sam Adamson into YouTube, you'll find kind of longer sets on there if you want to have a look at those.
Cool.
But other than that, that's pretty much it. I'm not going to tell you my home address, so you can't come here. Sorry. Instagram, Sam Adamson, Facebook, Sam Adamson, and YouTube, the Sam Adamson.
Cool. You can find us on Instagram, Open Mic Comedy Pod. All the W's, openmiccomedypod.com. If you're whatever platform you're listening to this on, please give it a nice little review, would be handy. Don't bother with 1, 2, 3, or 4. Let's just get for fives. And yeah, if there's anybody else you think would enjoy this, please share it with them, get the word out. And if there's any comedians out there that fancy coming on, telling their story, just get in touch and we'll get you on as soon as we can. So thanks very much, Sam.
Thank you.
And until next time, I'll see you all soon.